I know this seems different than that, but you really have been here before. You really do know how to get through this loss of control.
Guys, welcome back to Failure. This is the place where, as they say, success has many fathers and failure has none. Well, failure has found a father, and you're here with us. We're very lucky today to have not only one of the most distinguished leaders in our community in Los Angeles and California and the Jewish community in the United States, but also a dear, dear friend, Rabbi Leder. Welcome, Rabbi Leder, to
Thank
show.
You. Thank you. Coming. Honored to be here.
We're really honored to have you. So Rabbi Leder, for those of you who don't know, I think he was recently named in the top 10 most influential rabbis in the world.
No. Newsweek magazine, I don't know how many years ago, a couple of times named me one of the 10 most influential rabbis in America.
In America.
The world is next.
Well, I think America would be the world in terms of, well, I guess.
Well, there's this little country called Israel.
Sorry. Good point. We're already jumping right into it. Also is a best-selling author. His books have helped me and helped many, many people, but also is a member of his congregation, and I have the proud distinguishing point in my life that I was his first bar mitzvah. And that was something that obviously I'll always remember. I don't even know if he remembers. But
oh, every word. Every yeah, word. Sure. Every word.
Because you had no other bar mitzvah.
1987.
Ever, right?
See?
For me, it's really, this is a very special episode we have and something that I just feel lucky we have him, especially in today's climate. So, Rabbi Leder, kind of jumping right in, the point of failure and as a podcast and as a show is our world, our kids, our adults, they see today in this kind of Instagram world, as I call it, so whether it's Instagram or TikTok or Snapchat or YouTube, everything looks so pretty and perfect and it's quick and yeah, everything seems so easy. And really what we hear people talk about all day long is success, you know, and success seems to get more and more material as we go on. You know, it's look at my Ferrari or Lamborghini or, you know, my boat or how cool my life is. And, you know, with today's influencer world, you know, it really speeds up because it's all of a sudden you see 21-year-olds seemingly just snap their fingers and have everything. And I think it's made the world, I don't want to say a shallow place, but a sad place, because you feel, if you don't have that, you're comparing yourself to that and you start to feel, you feel like a failure. And so part of the purpose of the show was, having had a lot of failure myself and a lot of success, I always explain that for me, my success is just the things that happen between my failures, those little small moments. And we're bringing on the leaders and I'd say the most people who are most successful in their fields, in you being the most successful in your field, but someone who also deals with every walk of life and yes, in every part of life, to talk about not their successes, but their failures and how it defined their successes. Mm-hmm. You know, and we've touched on a lot of really important topics that come out. Nigel Lithgow, who created American Idol, So You Think You Can Dance, explained his first failure was actually trying to commit suicide when he was 20 and how that defined his whole career. And we got into mental health. And Bryce Hall, who's an influencer, arguably probably the most famous influencer right now, started out by saying, oh, my first failure was when I lost my boxing match. But an hour in, he was admitting he was bullied at school and eating his lunch in the restroom. And it's what led him to doing live podcasting or live becoming an influencer, if you will, because he had no friends. As we get through all this, the first thing I always ask everybody is, what was your first failure you remember? What's the defining moment in your life that you remember saying, oh my God?
Well, first failure and defining moment, they might not be the same.
Defining failure, I would say.
So I was madly in love when I was in high school with this woman. And finally, like halfway through junior year, I closed the deal. And we were together all the way through the rest of high school and college. And then I went to Israel to start rabbinical school, and she came to Israel. And it, you know, I was pretty young at the time. I was 22 years old, and I didn't know a lot about relationships, certainly about good relationships, because I grew up with parents who were unhappily married, always. And she, I didn't pick up the signs that it was falling apart. And then she moved to this little town in Israel to do volunteer work. It's, you know, a very poor little enclave. It's called Hadera. I go to visit her. I get on the bus in Jerusalem. I go there and I walk into her apartment, and she's sleeping in bed with some Israeli soldier, right? And
that's crushing.
Yeah. I mean, I was a kid. And I was shocked. And then, and I felt all the things you could imagine, heartbreak and disbelief and betrayal and how could I be so stupid and all of that. By the way, it was a torturous ending, because then she came, we were together again, then apart, and, you know, until the last shred of my dignity was destroyed. Oof. And what I realized was that I could not control everything. And the humility that comes from that is extraordinarily important and instructive. And frankly, deeply spiritual, when you give over to the idea that you really don't control very much. And that is terrifying and liberating at the same time. You know, there's always dissonance. There's always duality in life. The thing I've learned the most, I think the most spiritual insight I can ever share with anyone, is there is a duality that sustains life itself. There's this dichotomous tension that keeps us moving and alive. Failure leads to success. Success is destroyed by failure. Memory is beautiful and memory is painful. Both. In one of my books, I said it's like being caressed and spat on at the same time. That's memory. We love our parents, we hate our parents, right? We love our kids, we can't understand our kids, and they disappoint us. We have this dissonance, this dichotomous tension, as I said. And one of them is, I love this person, but I have no control over this person. And whether or not this person loves me. And this idea that love, frankly, isn't even enough. If you don't love each other, you can't have a relationship. But just because you love each other doesn't mean you can have a relationship. It's the first 50%, but there's a whole nother piece to it. So I would say that that moment, that cold water in my face, that was one.
That's a big one at a young age.
It was a big one at a young age. It was painful. It was, as I said, sort of slow and extended torture.
Did it lead? It sounds like, because you said so much, you know, and so much came out of, obviously, I'm not going to say so little, because when you're that age, that's like, you know, the end of your world almost. You know, I went through something similar. But it seems like a lot of what you, I don't want to say teach today, because I don't.
Well, it comes partly from that, but partly from other experiences. I was in a really, really frightening car accident and ended up not being able, essentially, to walk. I couldn't walk because my spine was injured, and I'd never felt pain like this in my life. When it really hit me, I was in the car, pulled into the garage, and when I tried to get out of the car, there was a knife in my back, and I couldn't stand, I couldn't walk. And so I opened the door and kind of used my upper body and spilled out of the car onto the garage floor, and then I pulled myself with my upper body across the garage floor, you know, through the oil and all of it, and up three steps into the house, which leads directly to my study at home, and that I couldn't move. And I was just begging. I was just fetal and begging. And that taught me a lot. That vulnerability taught me a lot.
When was that?
That was about 12 years ago.
I remember when you were kind of going through the rehabilitation of that, and what a hard time that was.
Yes,
for you.
And I gave, I think, one of my best sermons. It led to one of my books. The book's called More Beautiful Than Before.
During a very hard time in my life, it actually helped me when I needed it the most.
Yeah, More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. And I guess what these failures teach, and I can tell you, again, I don't know so much that it's a failure as it is making peace with your limitations. My dad was diagnosed at 75 with Alzheimer's.
I remember this.
And there was nothing I could do but love him, of course, and support and protect, but...
Your dad was your world, I remember.
Well, he was... There's dissonance there, too. He claimed me at a very young age. I have three older sisters and a younger brother.
Right.
And my younger brother is gay. And the way my dad saw it, I'm not defending it, I'm just telling you how it is it was all on me.
Oh, because you, I understand.
And he claimed me at a very young age and set me on a path. I was his, and he was frightening in many ways. And of course, so I have this couch in my office I call the couch of tears.
I've been on it a few times.
Yeah, you have. You have, yeah. So I have not only my own experience, but the vicarious experience of so many others who go through painful things. Now, failure is a source of pain. Pain does not always indicate failure.
Correct.
Right?
Well, the reason, and I want to come back onto this path, but the reason like we use failure, and I came up with the word failure, is like most people think of failure as a terrible thing.
Yes.
You're a failure, right? You failed. And it hit me pretty late in life. When I say late in life, you know, I'm in my late 40s, but I was about 40 something years old. And it just hit me. I had just failed at as you know, my studio. I built a studio from scratch and went into a hostile takeover and you know, put into a bankruptcy. And I spent 2 years with press literally shitting on me every day, which I later found out was paid for press, made it even worse by the people doing the hostile takeover.
Yep.
And I always say I was one of those, like, I didn't want to get out of bed in the morning, sheets over, just didn't even want to like look at what was on my phone because I knew it was going to be another article rewritten the same way. And of all people, the person who called me, actually, you know, appreciate this, is Mel Gibson. Called me and said, who did you piss off? Like, what do you mean? He goes, what I did was a lot worse and you're getting worse press and it's getting written over and over and over and over.
Yeah.
You know, cut from that where I thought my life was over. I kind of left the film business, went into tech, went into aviation, went into biotech, but most important, had kids. And I woke up one morning and realized this is the happiest I've ever been in my whole life.
Perspective.
But it also was like, had I not failed, I never would have had to push forward to find the next success.
Look, if you ask most people about evolution, Darwinism, Alec, if I asked you, can you draw evolution for me? You would probably draw a constantly ascending line.
Yep.
Right? There's a countervailing theory about evolution that biologists call punctuated equilibrium, which means there's a stasis, there's an equilibrium, and then something incredibly disruptive happens, and it punctuates the equilibrium, and there's evolution. There's a leap, an evolutionary leap. So an asteroid hits the Earth, the dinosaurs are gone, but all these other species arrive, right? It punctuated the equilibrium. A car accident, an infidelity, a business failure, the loss of a reputation, the death of someone you love, a parent, a child, a brother, a sister. These things punctuate the equilibrium and they force us to evolve. That doesn't mean they're worth it. Okay? I'm not saying that the price we pay because of that disruption is worth it. What I'm saying is neither is it worthless. Right? Like what I say to people is if you have to go through hell, don't come out empty-handed.
I carry that with me every day.
It's in one of the books. Yes, that's... And I'm not trying to be cute.
No.
We don't get a choice. People we love die.
Right. Well, it goes back to your... We don't control it.
You know, I think... And for me, being a rabbi, there's so much in the sacred texts that talk about this. You know, we tend to think that people who lived 3,000 or 2,000 years ago had different problems than we do. No, they didn't. The human condition hasn't changed in 3,000 years. We're not the first people to live through a plague. More than 200 years ago, most children didn't make it to their fifth birthday.
Oh yeah, 250 years ago, 300 years ago.
Women
died during childbirth.
There was no epidural and C-section with the, you know, with Netflix and crushed ice. You were dead.
There's no antibiotics.
No, you were dead.
Yeah.
No anesthesia, right? So death was a regular occurrence in people's lives. Robert Frost had 4 children die. So we can learn a lot from them, from the sages. So much of faith is about what we can and cannot control. You know, when the Bible says, which it often does, da 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 da, I am God. When the Bible says I am God, it is simultaneously saying, and you are not.
Yep.
You are not God. One of my favorite quotes is Marsha McLuhan. He says, I don't know who discovered water, but it wasn't the fish. You're so immersed in your own reality. When does a fish discover water? When it jerked out of it on the end of a hook and it's flailing and gasping for air. That's when a fish discovers water. When do you discover life? Life in the face of death.
So that brings me to a really interesting, one of the things you've written both, I think in 2 of your books and also in 1 of the sermons you recently gave, incredibly touching. I think you talked about how you've obviously spent a lot of time celebrating the happiest moments, but also the saddest. You're by people's bedsides as they pass away, which I don't know how you do, because I don't know many people that could actually do that.
You know how you do it? You walk in the door.
I was going to say, the advice, obviously, you give, as I read, is even if you don't believe it and don't feel it, you show up and you tell them it's going to be okay.
No, not that it's going to be okay. Just show up.
Just show up.
Just show up.
Well, the one thing that stuck with me from that in the biggest way was you said, no one ever said to me when I was by their bedside of the, I don't remember how many hundreds plus people.
Close to 1,000.
1,000 people. So, Robert, one of the things that I think is so amazing about you, and I can say this as a friend and you as my rabbi, I keep calling you Rabbi Steve, Rabbi. I'm like,
you can call me Steve.
Well, I mean, you bar mitzvahed me at 13. I have such a hard time even, but you are the most relatable person, not just rabbi. And that's why you said you have the couch of tears. And I've been on that couch of tears, whether it's divorce or going through my bankruptcy or, well, not I mean, company's bankruptcy or, you know, any time in my life, you know, and any time in my family's life and any time in my friend's life, you know, they've all been on Rabbi Leader's couch.
Yep.
And it's not because you're a rabbi. I mean, it's partially because you're a rabbi, but you have this way of connecting with people and an authentic way of connecting with people who have gone through their failure. And again, like when we were trying to think of what to call the show, the concept of failure. Failure is just that moment of like something didn't work and I'm just trying to get to the next piece of success, whether it's emotionally or...
Or sometimes it's much more profound and severe than that. I mean, there are people who truly have suffered a moral failure.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a mistake. It's not just the next step to success. I mean, I do deal with people whose lives are just turned upside down in an instant because their professed values and lived values aren't aligned.
Well, that's kind of where I was going to get at, which is, you know, you have a way to connect with people and see authentically. I don't want to say the best in them, but you see the best in them, but you see the real in them too. And you also help them. It's like your combination of a rabbi, a therapist, a friend.
You know how I do it? Before I say anything after listening, I ask myself a question internally, which is, where is that same flaw in me? Now, the way that the flaw gets articulated in the world may be different. For me, it might be alcohol, and for someone else, it might be gambling. I don't know. You know, I'm making this up.
Yeah.
But what I try to do is come from a place of empathy, not judgment. Absolutely. And the way I do that is I ask myself the question first. like, where is that flaw in me? Because then, without revealing too much, although sometimes I reveal quite a bit, now I understand you, Ryan, because I've taken the minute to think about, well, have I been on this same path and this same journey? Of course I have. I ask this sometimes almost rhetorically when people come to me and say, oh, Rabbi, you have no idea what she did, how horrible she was. And I have no doubt that's true. Are you so perfect? Have you never slammed a door? Have you never hurt someone with words? Have you never been a coward? So let's just try to create more empathy and less judgment.
It's really good.
Let's judge less, love more.
If you were talking, I mean, you are talking to hopefully the world. Everybody's going through something. And I don't
think everyone. You know, this is a strange feeling for me, honestly. When I'm up there on the pulpit and I'm looking out at a room with 2,000 people in it, I'm not saying this out of arrogance, it's just the job description.
Yeah.
I am the only person in that room who knows what
everyone's
going through. Not everyone, but I can look around that room and I can and say, oh, cancer, child suicided, third marriage, bankruptcy, cold withholding, narcissistic mother. I can just, diabetes, I can just dial into all of it. And it's a lot.
It sounds
like
a
lot to carry.
So how do you carry? I mean, you're carrying, and I'm going to use the failure loosely.
To your point, everyone is suffering. Everyone. That person sitting next to you in traffic or the movie theater or the restaurant, that person is in pain. I promise you, every person here is in pain.
How do you tell or suggest to other people, people who are going through, you know, their form of failure today and everybody else around them, kind of, people are so quick to judge. People like to,
oh yes.
I hate to say it, but it's like, you know, they say Hollywood loves a
Schadenfreude.
Yeah, Schadenfreude, exactly. So Hollywood loves a falling star more than they like a rising one. But the world somewhat does. And
yes,
it can be a very dark, lonely
yes.
place.
Oh,
and
yes.
I know so many people that go through it. What advice? I mean, I think you more than any person that I have had or ever will have on this show has probably heard more of it, seen more of it to more of an extreme. As you said, you've actually gone through, and I actually would love for you to tell as much of it as you can, the worst of the worst, because people need to hear it.
For me personally?
Yeah.
Okay. But let me answer your question. Yeah. Look, there's no one single approach, but I can give you sort of the broad brushstrokes. The first thing is, you know, if you came to me with some horrible problem, like, Steve, I just don't know how I'm going to get through this, I would first probably ask you, well, Ryan, up until this, what was the most difficult thing you ever got through in your life? And everybody knows. Everybody knows. And then I will ask you to tell me about it. And then I will ask you, how did you get through that? Because you did get through it. How? And people will say whatever they say. It may be, well, I relied on my family and, you know, I relied on my faith, or I leaned more heavily into exercise. You found a way. And I would say, well, I know this seems different than that, but you really have been here before. You really do know how to get through this loss of control or public embarrassment or private shame or some kind of addiction. I said, you actually have been here before, and this is ultimately going to come down to faith in yourself.